Happy New Year and all that. Good to see you on the first Sunday, especially when the Sunday is the first. Just goes to show you, I mean, you all really want it. That's good. It's good. The ushers are going to come forward. And if you came prepared to partner financially, there's lots of ways to say, hey, beyond singing or words or enthusiastic nodding, I want to be in, I want to be part of this, I want to be part of the story God is telling in and through this people, locally, globally. I want to be part of that. Finances are part of how that happens. So as the bag with handles poking out of the sides goes by, just know that that's not just part of our programming to pass the plate. It's part of how we entrust ourselves to each other and entrust ourselves and what matters to us to God so that we can be part of some really cool things. All right? So you guys doing all right? Okay. Yeah. I'm always suspicious of the woo, just so you know. You guys look like maybe last night you were, well, frankly, it looks like you haven't been to bed yet, some of you, so I just, I'm only here because I work here, trust me. I'm kidding, that's not true. We're going to get started on a series this month. We're going to go through this idea this month that I'm sure you'd agree, it's super important. And I realized on my drive up here today, there's a pressure. It's not a heavy weight or anything, but there's a pressure that comes with, what's the first thing you say? Not just the series for January of a new year, but what's the first message? What's the first Sunday about? Because, you know, maybe some people, they don't think about it. You know, it didn't occur to me that it had any more merit than the others. But maybe some other people, and maybe part of me, is like, what's the first thing you say? Is there a statement in the subject matter for the very first, especially when it's January 1st, the very first Sunday? What is that? What's the message in that? And so I think there is a bit of a message in that for me today, because we're going to be talking about something really, really, really important, because other times we just talk about, you know, but this time we're serious. But I was realizing that what I want to talk about today is, it's one of those really main themes, and I know that phrase, I say that phrase a lot, this is a main, like how many main themes can there be? But really realizing this is one of those, it's one of those ideas right at the center. If we can understand how central of a theme that the subject is today, it helps us understand the Bible. There are things that are like, I just don't get that. If you'll pass it through this filter, you'll go, oh, that's very helpful. Oh, now I get what the narrative is trying to get across. This is one of those themes that helps us in every area of life if we'll take it seriously. If we'll maybe put down what we thought it was about and re-embrace it anew. And it has to do with humility, humbleness. And many of us, when we hear humility, we hear humble, we think weak, timid, bottom of the food chain, willfully the loser. It's got a negative connotation, especially in our culture and in this time. Humility is not something that we're all trying to chase down, unless we can be known for being most humble, then we would be, that seems worth it. This faith in and of itself, it requires humility. And many of us, I think we know cognitively that that's true, but humility is running behind faith. And we, because by nature, you may or may not realize this, we hate faith. We like certainty. So we like to talk about faith, but what we're really after is we expect certainty from other people. We expect certainty from ourselves. We think God expects certainty, assurance from our life, our day-to-day lives. We expect certainty from pastors and from our churches. So we talk about faith, but we really don't like faith. The thing is, faith requires humility. It's very difficult. Certainty is easy. If you can be certain about something, you don't have to work anymore. Faith requires the work of humility. Forgiveness. Loving other people. To say, I am going to love you based on my merits, not yours. That's incredibly hard to do. That's why it was commanded. To love some of us will pat ourselves on the back and say, I love that person even though they don't deserve it. You see what's happening there? That's, Humility stops using the word deserved. I'm no longer measuring somebody's worth, them being worthy of love. That takes a great deal of humility, which is strength, not weakness. It's a strength. It's very, very difficult. Trusting people, entrusting yourself to people, takes a great deal of courage because it takes a great deal of humility. Being patient with other people, recognizing other people need your gentleness, they need your forbearance, or the Bible term long-suffering. They need you to really endure for the long haul. That takes a great deal of humility, and it's hard. So it's not weakness. It's actually strength. And this theme is braided throughout the scriptures. It's braided throughout our faith tradition. If you go all the way back, we talked about some of this on Christmas Eve. It's a theme we come to here and there here at Cross Point. You go all the way back to the origin story of humanity. You get this guy being fashioned out of that which already exists. His name is Adam, which in Hebrew is Adama, which means dirt. So in the ladies are like, I knew it. So, you know, this first guy's name is essentially Claude, right? And so, isn't that funny? This guy is formed out of the soil, out of the humus. And so, you can look at this and go, this is a very condescending story. But I've come to really realize it's a gift. The story is a gift because being fashioned from the humus, the human origin story, being made, created, formed out of that which already exists, is a way of saying, I want you to have the gift of always remembering what you are so that you can be really, really clear about what you're not expected to be. That's just not what you are. You got to note that it's not like human beings were created first and then God puts his arm around you and says, now let's watch this and make all this stuff. We come last. I mean, there's something profound about that, that we come from the elements of things that already existed. We are from the humus. We are lowly by nature. That's not a pathetic thing and it's not a condescending thing. It's a gift so that we're able to see ourselves accurately. So that we can take pressures off of us that weren't supposed to be there in the first place. So that we can treat other people with the respect and the forbearance, and with the proper amount of expectation. Yeah, we come from the soil. This allows us, and this is one of the greatest gifts I've learned. It allows us to be reminded that we are not the source. A different origin story that would put human beings up at the top of the food chain somehow would maybe give us the sense too easily that it was all dependent on us, that we are the source and the animating life source in our life. And it's a real gift to me when God has said, you dummy, I'm God. Oh, that's God, that's right. No, you are not the source. It doesn't depend on you. This doesn't rest on your shoulders. You do what you're responsible for, and I'll do everything else. There's a gift. There's a peace. It pops the anxiety balloon, and everything comes back to shalom when I recognize, oh, that's right, I'm human. Humus, human, humble, humiliate. All of those have the same etymology. And it's a gift. It's not condescension. It's a gift to be reminded of what we are so we can be entirely clear of what we are not. And so the reason this is so fundamentally important to really understand humility is because what our goal is in this faith is not to become lofty, floaty, spiritual things that we're not now. Our goal is to become human. The issue isn't that you're a human and that's a bad thing. The issue is we were made human and somehow we've veered from that. And that's what's wrong. Humility is simply realigning with what we really are and then therefore aligning in the proper relationship to each other and to God, the God that made us and said it was good. Like, this is what I meant to do, good. This is the goal of our faith, is to be properly human, and that the pathway to that is humility. Now, throughout the scriptures, there is a theme that actually plays itself out in a very specific phrase where humility is concerned. It pops up quite a few times in the Old Testament. It's quoted and said and spun a little bit in the New Testament. Jesus, in a conversation with some religious folks, people that were really starting to lean in at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, he says this in Matthew chapter 23, "Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." Those who exalt themselves will be humbled. I want you to understand that I admit it's fun to watch cocky people fall. I don't think that's what he's talking about. I don't think that my attitude reflects his. I just think it's fun to watch arrogant people, you know, come to their end. I think what's being said here is what's always being said, is those who exalt themselves. Now, when you hear those, don't think someone else. When we exalt ourselves, this, I say with respect, is part and parcel to what it means to live out the American dream. I want to be somebody, and not just somebody, but a little bit more somebody than everybody else. I want to earn a little bit more money. I want to be more famous. I want to walk in a room and everybody just starts clapping. That's really my goal. This was a pursuit of ours. And Jesus, who has gone on record of saying, "I'm for you, I love you, I want what's best for you, the thief has come to steal, kill, and destroy, I've come that you would have life and have it full." Jesus says, if you spend a lot of your time exalting, lifting yourself up, "Hey, look at me, I'm a self-made man or woman, I don't need anybody else, you need me," you will be humbled. That may be painful, because what you're talking about is a human being being reminded that they're human. And when you exalt, God's like, we're going to have to point the arrows down. You will be humbled, humiliated, humist. There will be circumstances in your life to help you remember what you're not. Because if you continue on this trajectory, you're going to kill yourself and kill others that you claim to love. This is not the design. Now, you can fake it for hundreds of years. A whole nation can fake this for hundreds of years until the whole of society is humbled. We've seen this. If you took history class, we've seen this over and over. Jesus says, those who exalt themselves individually, systemically, will be humbled. But those who humble themselves, I think a modern way of saying this would be those who are tuned into reality. And we have, every one of us, we have one or two of these people around us. They're like, man, their feet are on the ground and it's attractive. They're so tuned in that ordinary is just extraordinary. It's just beautiful how human they are. Those who humble themselves, they'll be the ones that I will exalt. And that's a good place to be when God exalts you. When you exalt you, it's going to be with that black and white trying to fly footage. It's just going to look pathetic. When you humble yourself, I will exalt you. This theme over and over and over. So the goal of humanity is to become a human. The goal of spirituality is not to become spiritual, it's to become a human. And in that, God says, okay, if we're all set on your humility, now I can exalt you and grow you and mature you. So right now, we're in a season that ubiquitously, everybody's got change on their mind. I want to improve myself. I want to better myself. I want to become something else. In some measure, depending on how grizzled you've become with resolutions over the years, we're thinking, all right, 2012's got to be better somehow. I've got to do something with me. I've got to improve. A lot of us have change on our mind. And so today, I want to talk about something that it won't immediately bring humility to our mind. We're going to have to think a little bit about how we define humility. Because I want to talk about, in the scriptures and in sacred history, the tradition being that God has this moment with a lot of people where he says, I'm going to invite you into some change. I want to invite you to change things. I want you to be part of change. I'm going to call you to something. And it's interesting how we have responded. If you go back to the story of Moses, remember, brought up in Egypt, and then he kills a guy, and then after killing a guy, he spends 4 decades wishing that his past didn't exist, and he's tending sheep, and so after 40 years, he notices this bush is on fire, and he's seen a brush fire before, but this thing just keeps burning, and it's not burning up, and it becomes kind of peculiar for him, and so he's kind of staring at this burning bush for who knows how long, and it says that when the Lord noticed, that Moses noticed, he's like, "Moses, I have heard the cries of the people the promise I made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that this was going to be the unique people to bring about absolute revolution, a person at a time, that the Jews would bring about the Messiah, that their seed would be more than the stars in the sky, sand on the shore, that this is going to be the light of the world, and from these people I'm going to change everything. I haven't forgotten that, Moses. I'm going to go rescue these people from Egyptian slavery, and you are my plan. And Moses hears all this, you know, he's taken off his sandals, he's talking to the Almighty, and he says this in Exodus 4, chapter 4, verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, "Pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and of tongue." This is his response to God, the Almighty Creator of all things. I think you got the wrong guy. Words is hard. So the Lord said to him, "Who gave human beings their mouths that he has this?" And I don't think that was his tone. That's my tone. But Moses, you're not thinking clearly. Like, you think I'm holding a clipboard saying, "Do you think you can do it?" I'm God. I'm saying, I'm inviting you to be part of this. And so they have this exchange. And then Moses says in verse 13, "Pardon your servant, Lord, but could you just send somebody else?" Gideon in Judges is being called to help save Israel from the hands of some pretty vicious enemies. And that's the threat of these enemies has really shaped a lot of their culture and how they do their day-to-day life and how they have to hide certain parts of their life. And it's really become oppressive. And then the Lord speaks to Gideon about being Israel's savior. And Gideon takes a deep breath and says, Judges chapter 6, "Pardon me, my Lord, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my family." So here's this big calling from a being that spun planets into orbit. "I'm kind of a wimp of wimps. Like, wimps take my lunch money, Lord. You've got the wrong guy." Jeremiah, the prophet, starts off the book of Jeremiah in the first chapter this way. "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I have appointed you as a prophet to the nations." "Alas, sovereign Lord, I don't know how to speak. I'm too little. I'm too young." See, in examples like these, these specific examples and other examples in the scriptures, oftentimes what you don't find is in God calling somebody, inviting the person into it, you don't get somebody saying, "This scares the crap out of me. This is a big thing that you're inviting me into." It's not just fear. You don't get confusion. Like, "Could you explain this to me? How's this going to work?" Like, that's what Mary did. That's what Mary's response is. Just such a great, humble response, because she doesn't say, "This isn't possible." She's just like, "Okay, I took biology class. There's a step missing for me to be pregnant. Could you explain this? I'm going to make sure that I get this exactly right." This isn't the reaction you get out of these guys. You don't even get I'm talking to God. I kind of spaced out for a second. Could you repeat that? You don't even get that. You get people saying, "Relative to other people, I can't talk very good. I'm kind of a wimp. I'm not as strong as others. I'm too young." Like, how old is young? It's totally relativized. "With respect to comparing myself to other people, God, I am the wrong person." It's as if they're saying, "Let me get myself worthy of who you think I am. Let me tweak some things to get myself worthy of the love and the calling that you have on my life. God, I'm currently the wrong person." And many of you, when you read stories like this, maybe the comparison thing, it wasn't even the first thought you had. Because that is how normal it is for us to think about comparing ourselves. It's so normal to live in a world where we're constantly comparing ourselves to others, and we've forgotten that when you do that, something of you gets lost. There's a Chinese sage by the name of Trang Zhu. He tells a parable. He says, you hand a man a bow and arrow and let him shoot it. He has all his skill. But you turn it into a competition over a brass buckle, and his hands begin to shake. You turn it into a competition over a gold coin, and he sees two targets now, and he loses his mind. When it becomes something to compete and win, all his power is drained. Nothing about him has actually changed, but now he's cognizant that there are others and this is a competition, and how do I compare to everybody else with a bow and arrow in their hand? And he is lost by the comparison. All of these different ways that we compare ourselves to other people, it has become so common to us. We're so used to doing it. I can't tell you how many times this past year I've had a conversation with somebody that said, I no longer draw, paint, dance, sing something artsy. They don't do it anymore. And when I've asked them about why, the story in so many words is, when I was younger, I stopped doing it. And when I pressed them, it wasn't good enough. Now, our whole culture reinforces this. I mean, it would take a lot of meditation on our part to really believe a song might be a song if it's not 3.5 minutes long and isn't 99 cents on iTunes. It might still be music if somebody doesn't buy it. It might still be a work of art if somebody doesn't buy it en masse at TJ Maxx. But we've so reinforced that that's not what I am because it doesn't compare to others. See, kids don't do this. All kids are artists. Ask them. And then you grow up and you start looking around going, okay, theirs is getting more attention. I'm not, and they stop. How many times, just in the last year, I've talked to adults that have shut down an entire lobe of their brain. Why? Because it's not as good as, and then they name off family members or famous painters or musicians, and they stopped being what they are. They lost themselves. I'm the wrong person. I can't do that. How many people I talk to that are in careers, in vocations for 10, 20, 30, they're coming up on retirement, and they're doing something they hate. It has nothing to do with how they're wired. But early on, they were comparing themselves to their older brother, to their dad's legacy. They saw somebody get the accolades and the appraisal and the finances of another person, and they lost themselves anxiously and dove into a world that they didn't belong to. And have spent 50, 60, 70 hours a week of every week of their life doing something. It has nothing to do with them because they compared. I see people who they're called shy, they're called introverted. They've stopped participating for years. They just don't participate in any kind of creative process. They never get feedback. They never really stand up for what they believe in. They just kind of roll in on themselves. Now they're shy. They're introverted. No, the issue is a long time ago, they decided everybody else is faster, funnier, and smarter. And if you compare me to somebody else, I just should keep my mouth shut. And they rob other people. This isn't a guilt trip, but they rob other people of their unique perspective because of the anxiety that comes with comparing. Some people have lists and accumulations of interests and hobbies, and if you press them, if you earn the right to ask them about it, they're not really my interests. I'm not really interested in these things. I just kind of like the idea that I would have a collection like so-and-so, or that I would be involved just like so-and-so. It's rooted fundamentally in comparison. It really has nothing to do with their interests. I hear people talk about hating their life. I've just given up hope. I hate my life. And there's no basis for that if there are no other people on the earth. But it's that they can look and see that she's got a life I wish I had, and his job has meaning, and they've got parents I didn't get, and they and she and them and he. And it's comparing. It's the misery is a self-inflicted misery rooted fundamentally in a comparison and a competition with others. We're so used to doing it, and we're so used to the misery that comes with it. We can't, some of us, conceive of another way of living. And so it's worth saying then that the church has oftentimes not been real helpful in this category, because the church is a place, is the religion, is the organism that brings you in and says, you're terrible, change into what? Anything else. You're a sinner, you're evil. This is doctrinal. We hear this in sermons, and I say this with respect to anybody that carries a different view doctrinally, theologically, but some of us learned that you are fundamentally bad, that at the core of what you are completely evil. Until you cross this line, say this, sign this, take this class, do this, that you're totally depraved. And it grieves me to think that some of us have spent multiple decades of our life believing we and other human beings are totally depraved. And that the church is speaking for God when it says you need to change, you need to start doing this, you need to say this, you need to take these seven words out of your vocabulary because that offends God. You need to start going here, you need to stop going here, do stop doing all of these things. The church has said change, 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 change. And that they're comparing, so and I say they, but I've done this. You're comparing human beings to an ideal. There's no specific human being. It's I'm comparing you to a doctrinal ideal of what you should be. This nebulous, intangible human that doesn't exist, that you're not like, that you should be like. And so we divide ourselves up. We dice up ourselves. It's us and them, saints and sinners. Saints, by the way, is nobody that's alive now. Have you ever noticed that? You have to be dead for decades so that it becomes romantic. But everybody that actually knew him was a saint. Change. You are fundamentally bad. You've got to change. And so guilt and shaming what is to see if we can become someone else's idea of what should be. This has been religion for some of us. We grew up in the church and we left and we're now back. We've been here the whole time. We didn't have the guts to leave, but yes, I believe this. Or welcome to Cross Point, first day in church ever. A lot of us, this we've kept religion and church at arm's length because the message we have interpreted has been you're fundamentally bad and you just need to change. You need to become something other than what you are. And so following Jesus is just one more way that we compare ourselves to somebody else and we tweak and change our behaviors while what I really am remains unchanged. It's just one more anxious game of trying to become a better talker, tougher, old enough to be respected as a prophet. Because what I really am, I'm the wrong person. And when we're talking faith, we're talking love and happiness and eternal bliss is on the line, right? So I'll change. I'll change without fundamentally understanding myself. I'll just start changing my behaviors while the inside of me remains unchanged. How many times have I heard somebody say, man, I need to work on faith. I don't pray enough. You know, I don't read the Bible enough. My standard response is, how much is enough? Double it. See if you feel less guilty. You won't. Man, that guy, he gets up at 3:30, is late to work every day because of the Lord. He prays, he's got the big thick calluses, all of his jeans have pads right here. He loves Jesus. I think Jesus he's got bunk beds with the Lord. I don't pray enough. Yeah, that guy you're talking about, he was in my office last week watching you saying, I wish I was like that guy. She's got the life. He's got. We do this spiritually. I don't pray enough. I don't read the Bible enough. I'm not nice enough. I'm not generous enough. The standard is just a constant comparison with ideas, ideals, other people. The real issues aren't ever really dealt with. They're never really dealt with. So Paul, the Apostle Paul, he stops playing this game. He says he used to play the comparison game. He actually says, I used to have a lot of stuff that I brag about. Where's where I'm from, here's my family tree, here's all the things that I care about and could do and all the things I know. And then at one point he's like, I've decided that's rubbish. And he discovers what I hope to continue discovering. He says, well, you're not supposed to go around in this faith going, am I as good as him? Am I as good as her? What he says in so many words is he realized that God doesn't look at you and go, why can't you be more like? God never does that. God is trying to help us understand what we are supposed to be. Not becoming more like somebody else, but to become what we actually are. That God is always inviting us into life. God compares us with ourselves. And so Paul says something really, really interesting in Galatians chapter 5. He says, I say, walk by the Spirit. In other words, live by the Spirit of God. Let that be your guide. And you'll not gratify the desires of the flesh, which is a fancy way of saying you'll not live your life as though satisfying your urges, appetites, and impulses is all there is. Like, you're just a fancy two-legged animal. That's you're a bald ape. That's all that you are. He says, no. Walk by the Spirit, and your life won't be like that. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. These are opposed to each other to keep you from just doing whatever you want to do. Like, nothing's going to come easy. There's a tension inside of you. And for Paul, it wasn't, I'm constantly worrying about, am I better or worse than that person? Am I better or worse than those people? He says, no. It's an internal tension to say, is selfishness, flesh, impulsiveness, me-centeredness, is that winning out? Or is the Spirit of self-sacrifice and others-centered love winning out? Paul is concerned with an inside tension because God looks at us and says, oh, let me help you become what I dreamt you up to be. Eugene Peterson, he paraphrased the Bible. He made it more conversational. He's been doing this for years. He's a scholar. He speaks the biblical languages, and so he's translating it paraphrastically. And he took what Paul said in Romans 7, a similar idea that Paul stretches out over some more space. And I love this. See if you can find yourself in what Paul is saying in Romans 7. He says, I've spent a long time in sin's prison. What I don't understand about myself is that I decide one way, but then I act another, doing things I absolutely despise. One, two of you, maybe that's familiar. But let me help you. What I don't understand about myself is that I decide one way, and then by February, I act another. Does that help? So if I can't be trusted to figure out what is best for myself and then do it, it becomes obvious that God's command is necessary. But I need something more. For if I know the law, but I still can't keep it, and if the power of sin within me keeps sabotaging my best intentions, I obviously need help. I realize that I don't have what it takes. I can will it, but I can't do it. I decide to do good, but I don't really do it. I decide not to do bad, but then I do it anyway. My decisions, such as they are, they don't result in actions. Something has gone wrong deep within me and gets the better of me every time. It happens so regularly that it's predictable. The moment I decide to do good, sin's there to trip me up. I truly delight in God's commands. Like, I really enjoy doing the right thing. We could all say, yeah, it feels better when you do the right thing. But it's pretty obvious that not all of me joins in that delight. Parts of me covertly rebel, and just when I least expect it, they take charge. I've tried everything, and nothing helps. I'm at the end of my rope. The literal Greek there is, I'm exhausted. Paul says, I'm exhausted. Is there no one who can do anything for me? Isn't that the real question? The answer, thank God, is that Jesus Christ can and does. He acted to set things right in this life of contradictions where I want to serve God with all my heart and mind, but I'm pulled by the influence of sin to do something totally different. I'm exhausted. I'm at the end of my rope. Can somebody help me with this? But he's not saying, can I be as good as him or her or mommy and daddy or brother and sister or pastor or coworker? Or it's Christ. Christ is the standard. Christ steps into the exhaustion and doesn't say, hey, I'm perfect. You're not. He says, I'm perfect and I will die for you. Thanks be to God that Jesus Christ is the standard. See, part of what it means to be humble, part of how we define humility is facing what's actually true about you. Not what should be, what's actually true. And then recognizing that Jesus is the standard. And when you find that I'm going to fall short of the Jesus standard because he's kind of got the God card up his sleeve. Jesus doesn't say, ha ha, I'm better than you. Jesus says, I'm perfect and I still love you. That's the standard. Humbly allowing myself to be loved as I am. That's a great starter definition for humility, for humus, of knowing what I am. It's humbly accepting that I am now loved, rather than insisting that I get the conditions met so that I can be unconditionally loved. How crazy that is. The anxiety with trying to earn love you already have. humbly accepting that I'm already loved as I am. And so as we talk about change, the resolutions that we're making, the diet and exercise and healthy stops and healthy starts, and what we're going to do with family and relationships and hobbies and work and money and our plans and our schedule and all that, don't change any of it. How's that for some advice? I love this church. Don't change any of it until, as you currently are, you stop exempting yourself from the love of God. And this is how humility can be a little different than we anticipated, because you think you're being humble by saying, I'm no good, my past is too dark, I'm too meaningless, I'm too lazy, I'm too little, I'm too much. It's arrogance. It's a quiet, inverted arrogance, but it's arrogance nonetheless, because you're saying, I'm exempt from God's love. I'm not good enough for it. God said, I'm going to send my son to die for all of you. Oh, you. It's arrogant. You're trying to be special in a whole different way. It's pride. To humbly accept, I am currently loved as I am. If you change before you accept that, you're not changing you. You're just changing your behaviors. You're just putting a spin on your performance. You're wasting your time. It's just more anxiety and more not you. Don't change anything until you accept that God loves you. Then the changes are rooted in love, not an anxious performance to get love. Then becoming a healthy person, I want to eat better, I want to be physically fit and all that stuff. Now you can know, I'm not trying to be sexually attractive. I recognize I want to live a healthy life for my family, my friends, and for strength. I want to be part of something that does something. And when I just kind of give in to the selfish impulse of just kind of me, yeah, that's, I'm just killing myself and I'm robbing other people of whatever it is that I can add to the conversation. Now when we talk about monetary or vocational goals, it's not just, I'm going to set these goals so that I can finally be a person worthy of respect. You'll be miserable by March. Instead, it's no, I do these things because I recognize God is inviting me into something where I get to, in every definition of the word resources, I get to participate. Now, when going to church on Sunday isn't to check a box and get God off your back. Now it's, I want to be part of a community that does something. Now the reason, maybe I'm not going to go to those places on Friday night. It's not some hyper-spiritual religious reason. It's, I'm trying to make wiser decisions with my life. I'm trying to think bigger than just today. I'm trying to think about my life in a more holistic kind of sense. There will be things that maybe you feel like you're being asked to do by God, or that the momentum of a community is doing, like, man, I don't get this yet. But, you know, I'm just going to trust my Father in heaven that he wants good things for me. It doesn't totally make sense, but in humility, I'll take a step. Not to get him to love me, but because I trust that he does love me, in humility, yeah, I'll take that step before it makes sense. See, there's a huge difference. But don't change anything until you recognize right now you're not exempt from the love of God. And then once you have that, notice that the changes are the kinds of changes that last and mean something forever. Go in peace. We'll see you next week.